Hey, guys.
Hey, Phil.
Hey.
Hello, Mr.
I want to tell you that the people that live next door to me are putting in a swimming pool. And the truck just showed up, and these guys are making an unbelievable amount of noise. So I just want you to know. I remember Patrick used to always have his landscapers come. Yeah, so I might have to. So if I move around, you let me know if the noise gets too loud. Right now they're kind of quiet. But to make matters worse, my daughter has a bird, and it's usually very quiet, but she's screaming at the noise outside. So I'm going to do the best I can, but I may sound like I'm in a rainforest construction site. So don't get thrown by it. How is everybody?
Good.
Made it through Thanksgiving, ready for the whole Christmas thing, and then the new year, and then we're off and running in 2016, right?
Yep.
How many of you were here when I spoke about that zeolite formula, the clinoptilolite, and I told you about the research that was going on with this scientist slash doctor from Cleveland Clinic? Anybody
yep.
remember that?
Yep, I remember that.
Okay. I'm going to get you guys access to it. You're going to be like the first people to get it.
Nice.
So we'll talk about that toward the end of the call because I have to prepare you because in the wrong hands, it's not safe, honestly. So it's not being released as a pharmaceutical. It's being released as a nutraceutical, but it can only be sold by doctors or you guys. Okay, so it's sort of cutting edge. I believe there's real potential here. So I want to make sure we talk about that, and then you guys need to send me your address that you want it mailed to, and I'll mail everybody a bottle of it.
Cool.
Awesome, yeah.
All right, so you saw my email. I've been traveling quite a bit. And as I have become partially accidentally, partially intentionally, kind of immersed in the field of medicine, I'm able to take a very detached look at the personal training field. You know, for the better part of my career, I was swallowed up in it. And now I'm able to, you know, move a distance away and take a look. And for many years, I've shared with you guys, I've been very frustrated by the field of trainers. It's bothered me. It's bothered me because I always sought a career with a professional element to it. I always saw myself as a professional. And it bothered me to see other people who were representing what I do for a living so poorly. And now that I'm detached and I'm not so much in it, I see the root very clearly of a lot of my frustrations. And I hear people give it all different names. They say, well, people have a sense of entitlement now. You know, everybody wins the trophy in the soccer tournament. Everybody gets a prize. There is no more first prize. So we can call it entitlement, or we can call it a generational expectation that is very different or far less than ours. But it really, when you think about it, has everything to do with perspective. It has everything to do with what they see in their mind's eye. And if that's true, then I believe that if I or we can shape a personal trainer's perspective, then we can make them successful, assuming, of course, they have the right stuff, right? Assuming, of course, they care and they have empathy and they have desire and they have hunger. Then I think, first and foremost, we have to shape their perspective. They have to understand some things. Because if they follow the mass of personal trainers, I would say, without reservation, they are doomed to a short career or a life of struggle. Would you guys agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So I wanted to validate my suspicions because I've been thinking about this, and I wanted just to find, without my bias, is this really true? Is it really a matter of perspective, or am I just being a dinosaur? Am I just really breathing down the neck of an industry that's doing just fine? So I wanted my conclusion to not have any bias because I know I have bias. So in every city I went to for business, different reasons, but I made it a point. Every city I went to a health club, which I do anyway to work out, and I made it a point to meet some of the trainers in the health club. And by the end of October, I had asked, and I have one notebook, I had asked 20 or 30 random personal trainers in six different cities, all just random conversations. Hey, you a trainer? We started talking. I said, I want to ask you a question. I would take out my notebook, and I explained, and I'm asking this of a lot of trainers. I'd really like your opinion. Are you comfortable with that? And I asked, what separates the really successful trainers from the rest? Now, I didn't have any pre-qualification. I didn't ask them how much money they earned. I didn't ask them anything. All I know is they were employed by health clubs. And the truth is, I don't know many, although there are some. I do know some. But I don't know many really successful trainers that are employed by health clubs. So when I looked at their answers, they pretty much came down to the same three, in different words, but the same three. The question is, what separates the really successful trainers from the rest of the field? Anybody take a guess at what they might have said?
How much they make?
That would be good. That would be correct, yes, but that's not what they said.
Whether they're written up in magazines or whatever?
Yeah, you're on the right track.
Meeting
culture. Yep, so here's what they said. Go ahead.
Do they want any titles, like bodybuilding titles?
These are the trainers who work in health clubs, completely random, but they all landed in these same three answers. They either told me the successful ones have advantages, meaning they have connections, or they have trophies, or they won bodybuilding contests, or they have visibility, or they have exposure. That was one answer that they all gave me in a different form. The second was, you're going to like this one, they don't take the time to learn, or they don't take the time to study, or they don't take the time to learn technique. And that one surprised me, but they're just promoters. Like, they're just sales guys. You know, they just go out there and sell, 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 and they really don't understand. They don't know what they're doing. They don't take the time to learn. So we have two reasons that people are successful in our field. One, they have advantages. Two, they're just great salespeople and they don't take time to learn technique. So the successful ones, according to that, are not really qualified. And the third is they overcharge, and there's a but here, and it's an important but. They overcharge, but they only care about wealthy clients. Isn't it interesting that nobody, and I'm telling you, not a single one of them, let me count. Let me see how many. 2, 3, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 13, 17. Thirty-three trainers. Not a single one of those trainers perceived that it had anything to do with talent or skill set or education or hard work. What do you think about that? I mean, A, does it surprise you? And B, am I the only one who sees something very wrong with this picture?
I think it's definitely wrong. I mean, but, you know, that's pretty much the industry standard, where there was a guy on Facebook by the name of Don Izzo who said he's out of training because the train, because it's young, it's everything you said just now. And I guess in his perception, and this guy's legendary, he's one of the writers, I think, for the NASM textbook.
Okay.
And and he was making the same kind of complaint, but I think that it's those people. I don't know. Look, I mean, it's people walk into a gym and they're looking to see about getting a train, and you have someone who is of a certain age or over a certain age, who may have been, you know, super fit at one period of time, and now has acquired 20 years worth of knowledge, and you see another one who's 15, 20 years or senior is in better shape. The uneducated consumer would have a tendency to go to guys in better shape, assuming that that guy knows more about fitness, and I think that happens pervasively.
Okay. I think there's more to that picture, though. I think the one who has the more knowledge, who may not have the same, you know, biceps and delts, should have enough life experience to be able to explain to people. I mean, I think to presuppose that success in any industry, aside from, you know, modeling or something where it's purely an aesthetic, but to presuppose that people who are successful because of some extrinsic factor is wrong. Now, are there exceptions? Of course. I mean, can we look at Jillian Michaels? How qualified is she? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know her personally. She may be very qualified. And in some cases, you can go, yeah, well, this guy was lucky. You know, she was just lucky. He was lucky. Right time, right place. But not the industry as a whole. So my next part of this was I didn't want to speak to celebrities. I didn't want to speak to the guys who might, in fact, you know, have that advantage. So here's what I looked for. I looked for people who went through my programs. And these are people who came to my peak seminar. Tony, you might have even been there, 1995-ish. I don't know when you came. But
I was
there. I remember you coming to those events, yeah. Were you there when we set up in my store, when I had the store in Miami Lakes?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first one, I looked at three. I wanted to find three trainers who, by my standards, are successful. So the first one grew a business where he now has over $4 million in commercial real estate holdings. Now, when he came to my trainer weekend back in 1995, he came with a dream of opening a studio. That was it. He had nothing. He just wanted to open a studio. He was working for Health Club. So that was a long time ago. Well, he opened a studio. He wound up buying the building. Then he needed a larger space, so he moved into a larger space, bought that building, and rented his original space, and he continued that growth pattern. That, to me, is a successful personal trainer. Another one has four corporate contracts. That's all he has. That's his entire business, four contracts with corporations. He's got a staff of 20 who work for him. He generates over $1.5 million in gross revenues per year without any brick-and-mortar liability. He doesn't pay rent. He doesn't pay electric. That is a successful trainer to me. Another, left a health club chain the right way at 36 years old. When I say the right way, I mean he didn't open down the street and he didn't lie. He said, guys, I'm moving on. I appreciate the opportunity here and I feel like I've grown. I want to open my own place. He kept a relationship with them. 36 years old, he opened his own studio. He didn't have savings, so he took over $100,000 in loans with his parents as co-signers at 36 years old. And today, he is debt-free, he has a full book, and he has a studio netting as a business, $200,000 a year. Now, understand what I mean by that. His studio nets after he's paid, $200,000. So that is a business, five times EBITDA, that is a business worth $1 million. So these are three successful trainers, not celebrities, not well-known. They're not featured in the magazines. They don't do seminars. And I could have looked at a lot of others. Some people who have been through would be better. And Forrest Walden has done incredibly well. Sergio Rojas has done great. I mean, there are many people who went through would be better. But I wanted people who are not on TV, people who are not, you know, given opportunities. I just wanted to find out the difference in their perspective. So I asked them the same question. This was three trainers. And all three of them answered the question very differently than I'll say their less successful counterparts. So the first of the three most common answers, hard work, good mentors, integrity, and building up trust with clients and associates. Look at the skewed perspective. The ones who are struggling are going, oh, well, I can't do it because I don't have advantages, I don't have connections, I don't have trophies, I'm not visible, I don't have exposure. But I'm taking time to learn technique. I'm doing it right. Those other people, they're just salespeople, and they overcharge, but they're getting wealthy clients. I care about everybody. I'm not going to just do that. And here are guys who are really living it. Hard work, good mentors, integrity, building up trust with clients and associates. Okay, that sounds logical to me. That sounds reasonable. Second, work ethic, combining educational responsibility with a commitment to serving the clients. I find that interesting. Educational responsibility, every single one of them learns. Every single one of them attends conferences. Not as a speaker, they attend. So they will sit elbow to elbow with the guys who are struggling to earn $25,000 a year. So I don't think that it's accurate that these people don't take time to learn technique. And the third, and this was a big one, reliability. And I've always said it is so easy to thrill people because the standard is so low. You know, I have a microwave, and it has this vent on the top that opens when you run the microwave, and it's like a big panel, and the panel fell off. So I have a contract with Service America, and I called them, and I explained exactly what happened, and I said, is it covered under the warranty? And they said, we don't know. We have to send somebody out to take a look. And I said, okay, can you send somebody tomorrow? And they said, no. And we looked at a calendar, and between my schedule, I mean, they had such limited openings that we had to wait until December 8th, which was 3 days ago. And this is in September. So, you know, I got a microwave at the top. It's like wide open. And so I asked on the phone, I go, can you just tell me if it's covered? Because if it's not, I'll buy the part. I just want to know. I don't want to waste anybody's time. I could easily just order the parts from GE. No, we have to have somebody come out and take a look. I go, I can send you a picture. I can describe in detail don't you have my policy? Can't you just look at it and tell me if it's covered? No. So anyway, December 8th, the guy comes out. I have to stay home. He's going to come between 12 and 5. So thankfully, he comes at 2:30. Not that bad. He walks in. He looks at it. He goes, oh, that's not covered. I mean, I flipped. It was not his fault. But here I waited 2 months. They could have told me this on the phone. I could have bought the part. So now they ordered the part. Now I have to wait another month until I have an appointment with. So I'm just saying, if somebody just showed up and fixed it, I would hug him. I would give him $20 extra. I would go, man, you are the greatest. But the truth is, he just would have done what I needed done. So when you look at trainers, this is interesting to me. If they're reliable, they're thought of as exceptional. If they just show up on time, people go, they're great. They're just doing what they're supposed to do. But what does that say about the gap? So the third, reliability, always show up on time, do what is expected or more, and never leave a client dissatisfied. That's a pretty good modeling material, right? Hard work, good mentors, integrity, building up trust. So what if I took this to the other trainers? What if I was able to sit down with these guys again, which I'm not because I don't know who they are. But what if I were able to, and I said, hey, you know what? I spoke to some of these really successful trainers, and none of them had advantages, and they all learned technique. And they don't only train wealthy clients. And they gave me some advice. Would you like the advice? Here's the advice. Work hard. Get yourself a really good mentor. Maintain integrity. And get all your clients and associates to really trust you by being what you pretend to be. Oh, and by the way, there has to be a very high work ethic. And you do have to be responsible for getting educated, but you don't get a badge for that. That's part of the job that comes with a commitment to serving the client. And by the way, you also have to be reliable. You have to show up on time, do what's expected or more, and never leave a client dissatisfied. I'm curious what you guys think. How would that advice be received?
They tell you they already do that.
Right.
Yeah.
They're exactly right. So does that make it hopeless? Because, I mean, how do you communicate? Do you guys, I'm asking. You guys agree with me. I'm assuming you do, that the three successful trainers had some really good direction, that if I were a kid starting out as a trainer and I spoke to those three, man, I'd have a great career. If I spoke to the others, I'd grumble with them. I'd sit in the trenches and go, this sucks. Nobody wants to train with me. So it bothered me. I wish these things didn't bother me as they do, but it did. And I'm not going to say the medical field is at such a level of professionalism that they're all reliable. Believe me, it's pretty ugly on the inside. But the work ethic is definitely very different. The perspective is definitely very different. So when personal trainers are resentful because the doctor makes so much money, look, when I see their practices, I have to say in many cases, it's deserved. It's deserved, and it's not deserved by these trainers. So it's important to me, and I keep – I'm in this tug of war with myself where I go – forgive me, but I go, fuck the trainers. Like, and I don't mean you guys. But, like, why – I go, why am I doing this? I've spoken for years at the conferences. The same people – there's one guy, he works in the post office. He's come to every one of my events for probably 25 years, sends me emails all the time. You know, I'm getting one more certification. I want to – stop getting certifications, man. Don't do it. Just stay at the post office. Just – be a postal worker. Don't try anymore. Like, I'm just getting to the point that I don't have the patience anymore. But the tug of war is, then I'm giving up, and I feel like I do have the ability at some level to really leave a mark, you know, here in this industry. And again, I don't know. I don't really know. So I reached out to a few industry icons, and I just wanted to open up the dialogue. And I wanted to see if there was a way to look at, because admittedly, my 33 average trainers and my three success trainers, it's a tiny little microcosm. So I wanted to see if it was representative of the 400,000 plus certified trainers in the field. And I'll tell you this, it was. Amazingly so. It's almost like there are two schools. There are the ones who just really tell themselves rationalized to explain why they're struggling. And by the way, they don't readily admit to struggling. It takes a while. It takes a while for them to go, well, you know, I do have $30,000 in debt. Oh. How much did you earn last year? 28. Oh, you earned $28,000 a year and you're $30,000 in debt. That doesn't sound real promising to me. But they put on an air as if they're very successful. So in talking to Sal Aria and some of the different people who you would know, certification kind of initiators who've all matured, I really came up with the idea for a course, and I would like to release it in 2017. I'm not sure if it's going to be like a human kinetics product or if it's going to be through a specific agency, but what I really hope to do is I hope to align some of the top certification agencies and just have it mandatory. I don't want to make money from this. I want this course to just be put out there to everyone entering the field. And it's not about five a day, and it's not about how you market. It's about the foundation of what it takes to truly be a fitness professional. So I've been working on it, and I outlined 16 qualities based on all my conversations. So, you know, after what I just told you, then I accessed their list, and I spoke to many people. And that's where I found it amazing. The ones who are really successful are typically humble. And again, I didn't want the superstars. But the ones who are really earning a good living and have financial stability are actually operating in prime. The average age of the trainers who were doing really well was over 40. But they've all been trainers since their 20s. So we're talking about longevity. We're talking about people who really committed to this profession and stayed with it. Now, some of the other trainers were also in that age group, but they were coming back to it in most cases. They left the field because they couldn't make money. They went into real estate. The market fell apart. They went back to their passion. So when I really look at the longevity and success, I find that there are some real consistent factors. And I think these 16 traits apply. So I'm going to share them with you, and I'm doing it for two reasons. One is I know that everybody here has these traits. I know that everybody here will recognize every single one of these qualities. But I think it's a good exercise to say, am I really displaying all of this now? Because if you're not, and I think out of the 16, I would think most of you couldn't say you're doing 100% of them, it can really allow you room to improve. And the second is I would really love your thoughts and feedback because I do want to turn this into a course. A part of the challenge for what I want to do, put it out there, is some of the agencies, two in particular, are not for profit. The others are for profit, so they're not always comfortable aligning. So I want this to be a not for profit course, but an actual course that is somehow valued, not as continuing education, as mandatory. So we'll see. I mean, I set the bar high for myself. We'll see. Any thoughts, comments, questions before I share the 16 traits?
Well, you did set the bar high. It's interesting that you would want it to be mandatory. I find that I'm excited about hearing what it is.
But I'm probably out of my mind, right?
Yeah, you are. But it's okay.
But, you know, the thing about it is, rather than go to the certification agencies, a different philosophy maybe go to the people who you know in the industry who own chains and that could take it into the house for their people to be managed.
They don't care enough, Tasso. They don't care. They don't care enough. I'm telling you, they don't care. When I share the traits, they don't care. Really, although they're very good people, they're really about money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, Joe Cerulli, Jeff Dyer. I mean, if I got it in the hands of these guys who I've known for decades, something would happen, but it's not going to happen industry-wide. There's just no way. The question would be, how can I make money with this? Or clubs would start using this as a certification. They'd go, when you can pass this test, you're a certified trainer. I really think it has to happen from people who are in the field of education, that if you want to get a personal training credential, you need to take a course. And the course can be, 3 hours. I'm just saying there needs to be a lesson that you don't just go take people through exercise and expect to be a professional. And if you want to justify that, good, that's fine. But you're going to be a loser. That's really it. That's what I want to say. You know, you make that choice. If you want to go, I can never be a really successful trainer because I don't have connections. I'm going to go, okay, good. Then don't be successful. But don't ask me how you can if you're not willing to listen. All right, so here are the traits, and you can, interrupt at any time. But when I look at what the guys who are successful do, they've done this all the way through. One, they all teach. They all teach. Now, every trainer is going to say, I teach, but there's a difference. They understand, as you guys do, how important it is to educate clients. But that doesn't just mean have egg whites instead of the whole egg, which, by the way, I would sort of argue at this point. But it's more than just telling them what to do. And it's not only that the trainers who are successful understand how important it is to educate, but at a higher level, I'll say we understand that people don't see the sex appeal in education. You can't say I'm a better trainer because I educate, because the truth is nobody cares. So every one of these trainers has found a way to educate their clients without making it sound like I'm educating you. Some through written material, some through online stuff, some through workshops, some through regular meetings. Every single one of them has an educational component. Some require some hours where they actually just sit in an office and go over things. So we understand teaching is vital, but I think it's different than just teaching them what to eat or teaching them how to move. And I think the larger question here becomes, what is the trainer qualified to teach? There was a trainer in one of the gyms, and he was talking to his overweight client about what to eat. And I would guess he was chemically enhanced. He had acne all down the back of his arms, massive, bloated. And he said, this morning, before I worked out, I had 28 whole grain pancakes and a handful of strawberries. All right.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. That's fine for him. Obviously, it worked. If his goal is to get big and have acne, he's doing it. But that's not educating, right? So I think that it's not enough to say teach, because he can teach his clients how to eat like somebody who is a 25-year-old who's all jacked up, and all of his clients are going to get fat and die. So there's got to be some standard for what they teach. So that's the big question, is what is a trainer qualified to teach? And I believe the answer to that is in flux. I believe it changes from week to week, from month to month, from year to year. And it can only be supported by aggressive learning on the part of the trainer, by aggressive reading. And that, I don't mean of commercial publications, but of research journals. Now, trainers hear that and they quiver. And they think that doctors read research journals. I don't know doctors who read research journals. It's really funny, because when I present at these conferences, I pull up so many articles from the New England Journal of Medicine, from all of the industry trades, neurobiology. Nobody's seen these articles. They don't read them. They really don't read them. They get them, but they don't read them. What they do read is the literature that comes from the drug companies with a conclusion. They don't bother to actually read it to see, does this really reveal what the drug company is telling me it reveals? Because in the great majority of cases, the answer is no. So we can't go, well, we're just trainers, we shouldn't read research. And I don't expect personal trainers who got into this because they want to help people and they have a passion for fitness to suddenly become research scientists. But I think you start with the NSCA journal. You get a membership to NSCA, whether or not you're certified. I think you can still get a membership even if you're not certified through them. And you get their research journal. It's a good way to start a personal trainer reading a journal, because there's stuff interesting to them. They could see, you know, how different studies with cyclists were able to change VO2 max. And things that really are interesting, I think, to the personal trainer. So that would be a start. Now, again, I want your feedback, because if you're telling a student who's about to get certified, it is your responsibility to educate, to continue to stay on top of information. Are we asking them to do too much? And I think NSCA is really a good place to start, because it's real science. It's done by, you know, PhD students. It's very real. And if you want a great, and I'd say this to you too, if you want a great magazine to learn current science from, because it's moving more and more and more into nutrition and brain and immune system and of course, fitness and health and longevity, is Scientific American. If you subscribe to Scientific American, that's not a journal, but it's written as understandable science. And what you can do is, when you read the articles that interest you, whether they're about heart rate variability or whether they're about preserving brain function, you make note of the journals. You go, okay, because they reference everything. So it's going to say one, and you go to the bottom, and you go, okay, that was in this journal. Okay, that was in that journal. You make a list, and then you start to see which ones show up most often, and that would be a good journal to subscribe to. So let me ask again, knowing that I'm nuts and setting the bar high, Do you believe that's reasonable?
You're talking about the high level, Bill. A lot of trainers, and again, I teach trainers through that WITS course. I had trouble explaining to some of these new trainers that you have to read the book in order to pass the test. And I had some of them saying, well, I'm working so hard, you know, I have X amount of hours, I'm working 10 hours a day, I don't have time to read the book. And you're talking about the people who are really, really dedicated and say to themselves, I want to be a full-time trainer, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to do it no matter what. The average
I'm talking about if IFPA or IPFA, Jim Bell's organization, and ISSA and AFA and NASM and all the companies that merged, if they would really set some kind of standard that is really simple. I'm just saying that was the first of 16 traits. I just want you to learn that this is a requirement of being a personal trainer. Is anybody going to monitor you and make sure you do it? No. But I certainly want them to understand that it is a part of the responsibility. And I think if there was a unified focus on it, then granted, there would be those who go to trade schools and may not. But I think in that would lie the difference. Because the ones who are successful are a tiny dot on the field of personal training. And I hope you guys are part of that dot. But it's a tiny dot. It's a speck. So this is the frustrating part to me. And maybe I need psychological help because I don't know why I keep one foot in it. Honestly, I don't. I'm like, But I keep feeling like, I don't know. They don't get it yet. I want them to see. So you think I'm talking to such a small number that there's no way it's going to penetrate the field, Tony?
Yeah, I do.
Tasha, what do you
only
think?
The top people about it.
I would agree because I think you can't get most of these guys' noses out of muscle fitness magazines.
Well, okay. So is it fair then to have them take a course where they learn that this is a responsibility, knowing nobody's going to monitor them? But then when they're not successful, we say, go back to the 16 qualities. Did you do them? Right? They go, oh, you can't make money in this field. Whoa, don't tell me what I can make. You're telling me what you're making, right? That's what you can make money as a personal trainer. It always makes me laugh when people say that. I go, I can't? No, you can't. Me? I can't. You, nobody can. Nobody can make money in the personal training field. It's good I didn't know that. It's a very good thing I didn't know that.
I think you're back to the discussion we had on Tuesday on the isogenics, or maybe it was last call. You're back to that 3% are going to do that and be accountable to that because they desire excellence.
Good. Then 100% should learn it and 3% should do it. That's how I feel.
All right, Bill,
so we're still on trait number one. Got a little controversy going.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that one. Everyone should learn 3% and do it. That I'm comfortable with.
Here's the second one. Develop from day one professional rapport. Of these trainers that I spoke to, the successful ones, they don't talk to their clients about their divorces, about their children's problems, about their teenagers' drugs, about the parties they went to. They don't. They're extremely professional. Their clients not only like them, love them. There is professional rapport. So they don't call their clients dude. They don't call their clients bro. Yeah, I hear that all the time. Okay, bro, good set. It doesn't sound to me like professional rapport. Right? You think twice about a doctor goes, all right, dude, you know what? We're going to take out your appendix. What'd you call me? And there's an unspoken rule. The unspoken rule is this. The client can tell you anything, and you tell them nothing about your life, although you're extremely interested in everything they have to tell you. Now, that doesn't mean if you went to an award ceremony, you can't say it. If you went on a trip to Las Vegas, you can't tell them. But I'm talking about the personal stuff that I hear trainers sharing with people. It's ridiculous because, number one, it's lowering you at best to the element of friend. And at worst, it's lowering you to idiot. So this professional rapport thing is a responsibility of the personal trainer. Psychologists learn this. You know, you don't go to a psychologist and go, you know, I have a drinking problem. They go, oh, you think you have a problem. Let me tell you what happened with me. I started drinking Kettle One vodka, couldn't stop. I gave up the vodka and I went to heavy drugs. They don't do that. You'd walk out of the office. So why is it okay for trainers to tell about the women they slept with or the parties they went to? I mean, I hear it constantly. Do you? I mean, do you guys hear it? No? Maybe I'm hanging out in the wrong places.
Yeah.
I do. I hear it. Working with other trainers.
I'm shocked. Like, I just want to take up my sock and stuff it in the trainer's mouth at some point and go, what are you doing? Shh, shh, here.
That, and then this. You got to hear the story, like, through all their clients. They tell everything.
So, yeah, I think nobody ever taught them. Nobody ever taught them that that is wrong. But it is. And I would also say with that, as a trainer, there are times you have to redirect. In other words, the client might tell you something that's inappropriate or you don't want to know. Maybe you don't want to know about the affair. Maybe you don't. So there are times you might say, you know what, hey, interesting, let's not go there. Okay. Now, very little of the regular conversation will really relate to exercise. If you have a client 3 times a week for a year, how much can you talk about exercise, right? So I think the trainers sometimes feel like if they're not talking about exercise, they go to their personal life. And you've got to become professional enough to talk to somebody, to ask them questions, to listen, to care, and at times redirect. If they start to tell you something that you don't want to know, you don't want to hear, is none of your business, you can go, you know what, we're not going to talk about that. But tell me about last week. Very little of it has to relate to the actual exercise session, but stay out of going too far into someone's personal business whenever possible. So number one, you got to teach. Number two, you have to develop professional rapport from day one. Number three, establish a one-way power flow. This is another pet peeve of mine when I hear a trainer say to the client, what do you want to do today? I hear it all the time. What do you feel like doing today? And really what they mean is, what body parts do you want to train? Where is the focus on the outcome, and where is the trainer having enough expertise to decide what they should do today? Why would the trainer ask the client? Imagine your car is really making a lot of noise. You bring it into the mechanic, and the mechanic goes, okay, what part do you want me to fix? I don't know. You're the mechanic. You want me to just remove the transmission? I don't know. Is there something wrong with the transmission? So why does the trainer think that's okay? What do you want to do today? Kettlebells. Okay. What is that? That's two buddies. That's what that is, two buddies. So, again, these are little things that completely shatter the professional image of the personal trainer. And these three alone, I guarantee if we together took a walk through our field, we would see these violated everywhere we went. Everywhere. Not just a few places. I mean, every facility we went to, with the exception of the ones that I'd say have a high level of excellence, this is common. So establish a one-way power flow, which you guys understand, but it's a relationship between a legitimate coach and the team. The coach doesn't usually go, well, hey, guys, what drills do you want to run today? What plays do you want to run? What do you want to practice? What do you want to work on? They don't do that. If they do, I think you need a different coach. So the one-way power flow really comes from having the ability to command. And I know when trainers hear that, they get uncomfortable with it because it sounds like you're going to boss them around. But what's interesting is they're willing to say, four more, right? They're willing to say that, two more. So that's a command. But then they go, what do you want to do next? And it kills the whole thing. You know, or I see the opposite. I see them pointing. Like the client finishes a set, and they point, and they walk ahead of the client. And the client comes over and out of the pull-down machine, and the trainer adjusts the weights, and they go, 10 reps. I mean, how much more impressive would it be if a client showed up and the trainer said, hey, congratulations, you reached the level where you've now really eased into a level where we can now do burst training. And let me tell you what it's going to do for you. And let me tell you how it's going to integrate with the weight training you're doing. And the functional moves that we're going to do today are not only going to help you lose more fat, but they're going to help you with your golf game. Like, what a difference between that and what do you feel like doing today? And I don't hear that often in the field. So teach, professional rapport, one-way power flow. Next, inspire the individual. What I mean by that is you have to know the individual. It's not just about prescribing exercise. You know, we have the advantage of knowing how to discern motivational types. But, you know, every person is unique, and that's as much a responsibility as anything else. learn to inspire, not across the board, because what works to inspire one might discourage another, but inspire the individual. That is a responsibility. Number five, connect with evidence and validation. Here's another one I frequently see and hear. When I'm speaking at an event, recently I spoke at Club Industry. Go, how many of you get results for your clients? Every hand goes up. How many of you get results for all of your clients? Every hand goes up. And then I'll look at one person and I go, all of them? And then there's sort of this sheepish, well, not the ones who don't show up. Oh, okay. So you, assuming we remove the ones who don't show up, do you get results for all of them? Yes. Okay. Now, is it fair to say that no result is a result? When you think about it, I guess. So now let me change the question. Are you getting the results that your clients want for all of your clients? Well, not the ones who don't train hard enough. Okay, let's remove them. And by going through this discussion, they're left with no clients at the end of the conversation because they're not getting results. So it's really bizarre to me that they go, yes, 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 I'm getting results. If we spoke to all of your clients, would they say they got the result they want? No, but they don't eat right. Okay, but so why are you telling me you get results for all of them? So I think there has to be evidence and validation. I think if you're going to make a claim that you get results, where's the evidence? I want to see it. If I'm the client, I want to see it. Now, when you start, do you have that? No, but you can have evidence of the strategies you use. If you're reading the journals, you're finding evidence more often than pulling evidence from someone else. You're going to start to develop your own from the very first client. And until you have that, you could use the feel, felt, found. I know how you feel. I felt the same way. Let me tell you what I learned. Or you could use stories or pictures or testimonials from others who already completed the journey the client's about to go on. And you document and you assess and you reassess, which we'll come back to. So evidence and validation. I don't know how many years ago, but in my office we blew up a poster and also became the back page of some local magazines and it said, real people, real results. Now I've seen that a zillion times since. But I remember there was Wayne, Jim, I remember the actual people who were on there, and Terry. And they were dramatic, dramatic results. And I had Wayne's belt, like a museum of Wayne's belts. Every time he'd like finish with a belt, we'd hang it on the wall in the office. So we had like a museum. So, you know, people come in and they go, yeah, these are real people. I had the evidence. Now, with Alive, I have the evidence. I don't see most trainers having that evidence. I hear them say things. I hear them make claims. I don't see the evidence. Number six, show progress honestly. Man, this is an important one. Show progress honestly. I remember being trained at Jack LaLanne Health Spas when I first started. If I think hard, I'll remember the guy's name who trained me. I could envision him. He was a bodybuilder. And he showed me how you measure the second time. So the first time you relax the tape measure. We measured, you know, hips, waist, chest, upper arm, calf. And he told me on which ones, like the waist measurement, you squeeze it tighter. So he showed me how the first time you do it relax and the second time you squeeze it tighter. So he could take somebody with a 36-inch waist and measure them at 34. Or he could take somebody with a 33-inch waist and measure them at 35 so he knows they're going to do better next time. That's what they were training me to do. I didn't do it, but that was the training. So if we really have the skill set, why would we deceive people? I don't even like, and I know some of you may use this, but I don't even like the idea of inches as a total, you know, lost 26 inches. I understand it. I do understand it. But I don't like it because it's a little deceptive, because if you measure enough sites, you're going to get a high number, you know? So I like percentage body fat. I like the pictures. I like the testimony. I like when somebody has gotten so much leaner that you can see it in their face, and I like when we had a testimony with the face before and after. You know, those to me are very real. I like the data. I like the blood pressure before, the blood pressure after. Of course, you know, I use the biomarkers now. But there's got to be some progress that the client is making that you can show them, or else you can't say you're getting results for people. I see personal trainers take body fat measurements too often, and I see them lie. I see them tell the client something different than the skin fold caliper says, because they want to show that the person's getting better. Yep, you were 23% body fat. Today you're 19. How come I look the same? Oh, because muscle weighs more than fat. Oh.
Okay.
Yep. I don't think you should ever do a body fat comparison less than 90 days. I don't think you should assess weight more than once a month, if that. But I think it's a huge mistake to overinflate results because the perception is not sustainable. In other words, if I squeeze the tape measure this time, what am I going to do next time? What am I going to do the time after that? I mean, sooner or later, I'm going to squeeze their guts out. And I also think that whether or not there's the progress that the client wanted or that you wanted, it opens up a dialogue. Let's be honest. You know what? You lost 2 pounds. The fact is you only lost 1 pound of fat. So, hooray, you lost a pound of fat. But what we want to see is 3 months from now, we want to see you lose significantly more fat than you do weight. So let's talk about the next milestone. Next time we assess, I think that's a healthy conversation. I don't think we should lie to the client about their results. And all of these things are because this is what they do. This is what personal trainers do. And I know all you guys know this, right? There's nothing here that's surprising you. Am I right?
Nope.
Nope. No.
Number 7, take ownership of the quality of the relationship. When I told you about the 3 guys and they said hard work, good mentors, integrity, and they said building up trust with clients and associates. They mentioned work ethic, combining educational responsibility with a commitment to serving the client. They took ownership of the relationship. Most personal trainers are very quick to dismiss the client who doesn't show up or shows up late or isn't getting a result. They're very quick to sabotage the relationship. Intentionally, no, but they do it because they blame the client. So I think it's valuable to unload any clients who drain you. So I'm not saying you have to sustain a relationship with everyone. There are times that you just don't want to train somebody, and we've all been there. But with that said, I would say never, ever, 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 ever blame the client's motivation or lack of motivation. Never, ever, ever blame the client's personality. Never, ever, ever blame the client's friends or family. From the moment you meet that client, you are building a relationship. And you need to take ownership of the quality of that relationship. And that's why I studied things like motivational types. How do I connect? It frustrated me that I wasn't connecting with a few people at the level I wanted to, and I've learned to get past that. But I think most trainers are just very quick to go, she's never going to get a result. Nah, she likes her wine too much. So they don't take any ownership of what will happen through this relationship. And I think in the event that somebody does leave, which will happen, find out why. This is really valuable, is to find out why. Because it teaches you something. And I think more often than not, when they tell you why, you will disagree in your mind. You will not think what they're saying is true, but that doesn't matter. When you push that to the side, you go, I'm not going to judge, I'm just going to listen. Then you have to realize that's their perception. So something you did gave them that perception. And what that means is you didn't take responsibility for the quality of the relationship. Number 8, establish fair value. Now, fair value means ask for what you're worth. Always, always ask for what you're worth. Always. If you want to get $100 a session because you believe you're worth $100 a session, then never ask for $70. Now, does that mean you're stuck? No, you're going to become more valuable as time goes on. You know, April and I had a conversation the other day. She was charging, I think, $60 or $65, and she worked her way up to where some clients are paying her now $125. So twice as much. Clearly, if anybody's willing to pay her $125, they see value in that. So from that moment forward, you have that value. Ask for what you're worth, always. You can raise your rates significantly once. and again a year or more later, but only if you have a new stable of clients. So what I mean is, if I'm training people at $35 a session, I can't just go, okay, guys, I went to a seminar, now I'm charging you $80. Nobody's going to pay it, right? What I would do in that case is I would say, you know, I'm going to raise your rates $4, and all of a sudden they're all paying me $39. Nobody will object to that. Doesn't seem like a big raise, but if I have 30 sessions a week, that's $500 extra dollars a month. But as far as a significant raise, you can do it once. But you got to have a new stable of clients. So I have my $35 clients, but I'm learning. I'm getting better. I'm building a reputation. And now I'm starting to charge people $70, and I get to the point that I charge them $75. Now I have a chance to raise my $35 clients, but only once. And what I might say is, listen, my rates are now $75. I've been honoring, you know, our old rate. I'm going to have to bring you up to my current rate, but I'm going to give you 3 months to kind of work up there. So as of March 15th, it's going to be $75. Now, what will happen is some clients will leave. But understand what you did. You now opened up those hours to get $75. So I find too many trainers will charge far less than they're worth and complain about the money they're not making, because they never learned this. They learned where the femur is, but they never learned that you should ask for what you're worth. And this is why I say this should be mandatory education for somebody coming into our field. Otherwise, how will they know? Number 9, contact each client once a month. It should appear random with unexpected value. In other words, don't say, hey, I'm going to call you the first Monday of every month. But you should call them. I personally, I think a phone call is better than email or text. But I know, you know, I'm pushing a boulder uphill there. But once a month. Why? Because it makes you feel like you care. It makes them feel like you care about them. And always with something different. You know, hey, you know, I just saw a movie, and I really think that you would find great value in it. I don't know, you know, you're going to have to let me know, but I want you to rent Supersize Me. I want you to just watch that because we can talk about it. Just make that phone call. It could always be something different. You know, hey, I just realized that we haven't updated your chart, and I know you made some real progress. So next time you can, just that little phone call means you're thinking about them, you care about them, but not more than once a month. Once a month is infrequent enough for them to appreciate it. But if you do it more often, it then sets the dangerous precedent of the client perceiving that you're too available. So strategically, you contact each client once a month. All these guys do that. Not exactly in the same way, but they all have contact with their clients beyond the sessions, but not excessively.
Hey Phil.
Yeah.
You know, it's unusual you'd mention that one, because the other day I was doing a little mind mapping to see, you know, how I, you know, in the conversation we've had about changing my model and my business and that. And one of the things I pulled back from the past, I sort of asked myself a question, what did I do in the past I don't do anymore that I really think made a big difference in that? I used to have the McKay 66. Remember Harvey McKay, Swim with the Sharks?
Yeah.
And I said,
yeah.
I got to get the McKay 66 back in place, because it gives you things that will spark you to know your clients, but also to call them and say, hey, I saw this movie that you probably would love, man, or
yeah,
that type of thing.
Absolutely, yep. But you got to realize nobody uses a Rolodex anymore. When you go back and read Harvey McKay's, it's all about the Rolodex, right?
Yep.
So you got to kind of update it. But yes, exactly right. So that's what I said. When I share this with you, I'm giving you a perception of the holes in our industry, but also I think what will happen is just what you just did is you're going to go, yeah, I know that, but I haven't really been doing that. And if you're doing all 16 of these, your business has to succeed at a high level. Number 10, create community. Before my office was destroyed in a hurricane, every Saturday morning I had a breakfast in my office. There was a local place that made healthy foods, and I worked a nice deal with her where she would promote, and she'd always come over and make these creative little breakfasts, and she'd have like these egg white souffles and really, really, really good stuff. So I would invite people, and it became an event every Saturday morning, even if I wasn't there, by the way. Holly would be there, and they'd have a nice breakfast. There were times I'd be out of town. Every once in a while, I did a live remote from my radio show with everybody there. Now, I'm not saying you have to do that, but it created a sense of community. You guys know for many years, I learned a long time ago the value of teaching people in groups, and that's how I run my Alive program. But it started with my Transform program, a 17-week program, 12 people in a group. They'd show up once a week for 17 weeks. Creates a sense of community. With Alive, that's a huge element in why people stay so connected to it. So you don't have to get your clients to all hang out together, but you could have a controlled social media group. And the reason I say controlled is you want to monitor what's posted. You want to filter things because you don't want one person saying, you know, this isn't working, and then that kind of opens up that conversation. So in most forums, I'd say be open and honest and address those things. But when you're dealing with your clients, I think you control the interaction to some degree. You could do a periodic webinar or a teleconference. You could congregate at a local health event or a food fair. You could find reasons to throw little parties, even if they're lunches, you know, two or three times a year. It could be for somebody's achievement, for somebody's birthday. But just create a sense of community because there is a bonding element that they attach to you. That's 10 out of 16. I would say if we went with a checklist, just about every trainer in the field would fail these if we stopped right at 10. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Number 11, document, review, reassess, and redirect. Document, review, reassess, and redirect. A lot of personal trainers now tell me that they don't do an assessment. They just do photos and body fat. I believe it's a massive mistake. Not a little mistake, massive mistake. If no other reason than just to be able to document the improvement, that's reason enough. So if I'm doing it for that reason, I want many areas where I can document improvement. You guys are familiar with the assessment I do now. So I do practice what I preach. I think the documentation, the review, the reassessment should include an assessment of outlook. You know, we ask people, what do you anticipate? What do you expect will happen? Rate these on a scale of 1 through 5. Your exercise, your activity level, your love for exercise. We're getting a sense of their outlook so that we can compare it. We're getting a sense of their motivation so we can compare it. Now, those are a little subjective, but then we also do a symptoms assessment. We have, I would say reasonably, you should have at least 12 areas of measure for baseline comparisons. Can there be more? Yeah, for me, there are a lot more. But that's how I provide the evidence. That's how I document. That's how I can show people this stuff really works. I show the clients who's experiencing it, and I show the clients who are new to come in. Number 12, you're going to have to be responsible to help a client overcome obstacles. Every single client will run into obstacles, every single one. Every single client will run into obstacles. If you don't help them overcome those obstacles, the obstacles will defeat them. It becomes a part of the trainer responsibility is to help people overcome obstacles. You do it together. You create an environment with the client where you can discuss impending pitfalls and creatively find solutions. In the assessment, I ask people, what will screw this up for you? They go, what? I go, what is the most prevalent obstacle that's going to get in your way? And they'll tell me. And this is a good head start because now I know what I have to talk to them about. I know where we need to kind of focus some of their attention, because most of these things are preventable if you know in advance, and if not, then the person can respond, but they need your help. I don't like when a client goes, I can't come in next week, and then before you know it, I'm going to wait a few months, and hey, I'll be back in January, and then they come back. I don't like it because all the time in between, they got worse. It's a bad reflection on me. So I think if you help them overcome the obstacles, you don't run into that. Number 13, maintain open, honest, two-way communication. Now, I'm not saying violate the one-way power flow, and I'm not saying violate the professional rapport. You still need to have two-way communication. I don't believe it's a good idea for a trainer to reprimand a client. I know many do. I know for some it's sort of protocol. I think it's a really bad idea. Nobody wants to be reprimanded. They're not your employees. I've heard some people go to boot camps and they go, oh, yeah, he's great. He yells at us. I don't know that that's the way to really create longevity. I think in the moment it might feel, okay, I'm motivated. But the day you're not motivated, the yelling is going to discourage you further. So I don't ever think there should be a reprimand. And once you do, you create a dishonest client. Because, you know, did you drink last night? Yeah. You did? I mean, we did all those workouts last week, and you told me you were eating clean and you had a drink. Next time what will happen is they'll still have the drink, but you'll go, did you drink last night? They'll go, no. Why do you smell like alcohol? I don't know. It must be on my clothes. I was in a place where there was alcohol. And we also have to know that even if you guys really live a pristine life and never drink and never eat sugar and never eat gluten and you only eat really clean foods that are from the earth, even if you do that, we must accept it is not achievable for our clients. You can argue that. You go, no, no, I want my clients to be perfect. Then you're not going to have clients very long. So open, honest, two-way communication. No reprimands, and perfection isn't achievable. Number 14 is a really big one. Control the clock. Control the clock. That was vital to those three trainers I mentioned to you. A session should be 50 minutes. For me, a session is what the client needs up to 50 minutes. I encourage my live coaches to do a 20-minute session if that's all that's warranted that week. But I would say a session, a one-hour session, should be 50 minutes. A 30-minute session should be 25. Is that fair? It's more than fair because you're going to take 5 minutes for the niceties of saying hello and 5 minutes for the niceties of saying see you next time. There's an hour. Because if you go over the hour and you have a client at the next hour, now all of a sudden you're late for them. I've had trainers argue that with me and go, no, but you appear to be busy. How about if you really are busy? How about that? How about if you really are busy, you don't have to be late to appear busy. You're really busy and you're on time. Wouldn't that be good? We got two more. Oh, they're banging away at that pool right now. I think they're just doing it to irritate me. Can you guys hear it or not?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard it.
Stop. Now, here he goes. He's taking out the big sledgehammer. Oh, I think he's playing golf, actually. He's hitting a golf ball into the pool. Okay. That doesn't make any noise. A 24-hour contact policy. You know, there was a time that I would say, don't give your clients your cell phone number. I think we're past that time. You know, there was a time that I was very selective who I gave my cell phone number to. Now it's just everybody's on the cell phone all the time. But I don't think that means you have to always answer it. I think what is fair and reasonable and professional is to have a 24-hour contact policy. That if you leave me a voicemail or a text, or I happen to like Vox. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. Voxer, it's called. Has anybody used it? It's pretty good. It kind of turns your phone into a walkie-talkie, and it's not like a talking text. It's actually a recording. So you just push a little button, and you leave a message, and they receive it as an audio, and then they can respond, and it builds up like a chain. It's like text, but it's audio. So what I like about it is you can do it while you're driving. So if somebody Voxes me and they have a specific question, at any point I can reply and they're not taking any more of my time. But whether you use that or whether you use text or whether you use regular voicemail, I don't make promises on emails only because I get such a ridiculous number of emails and my spam filter is far from perfect. So sometimes things get lost in spam, and I've had many people go, how come you didn't respond? And I go, let me find it. Let me look in spam. Oh, yeah, there you are. Sure, you sent it last Wednesday. So I don't make promises. I discourage people from emailing me if they need an immediate result. So they have to understand that you're busy, but they also have to understand that you care. So you will respond within 24 hours. That's beyond reasonable. What if it's an emergency? Okay, let's think about how many real emergencies you've had in your career as a personal trainer. How many? How often is there truly a personal training emergency from a client? Not that often, right? So if it's an emergency, okay, call them right back. But I think 24 hours, that's my policy. You're my client. I'm your trainer. If ever you have a need, a question, you can, you know, blank me, text me, whatever you choose, and I'll respond within 24 hours. Otherwise, you become a victim of random assaults of your time. Now, if it's regarding a cancellation, my policy has always been a 48-hour cancellation policy. If you do not give adequate notice, 48 hours, I know people are more comfortable with 24, I've used 48, then they will forfeit their retainer and they'll have to post a new retainer on their next visit. If they cancel, even with adequate notice, more than twice in a six-week period, then they are no longer getting the series rate. That's my policy. It doesn't have to be yours. But I'm saying 24-hour contact policy, 48-hour cancellation policy. So if they leave me a message Wednesday at 9 for a Friday appointment at 10 and they go, I'm canceling, okay, that meets the 48-hour requirement, but I may not call them back until Thursday, and that's okay. I'm still going to honor that they gave me that notice at the time they did, but it doesn't mean I have to call them right back. Any of these that you guys would disagree with and go, you got to get this off the list, it's just it's not right?
No.
Okay, drum roll please. Number 16 out of 16. Confidently direct people towards supplements, equipment, and resources. For those of you who know Tony Abbott, if he was standing in front of me, he would collapse right now. It's the argument we've had perpetually in all the time that I've known him. But he does acknowledge now, after years of denying it, that creatine works. So I made a little headway. Confidently direct people towards supplements, equipment, and resources. Now, does that mean that they don't need? Of course not. Of course not. Hey, Tammy, I'm curious, do you, because I know you work with certain populations, do you run into mineral deficiencies ever? Like, do people come to you and they went to their doctor and they had some testing done, or, you know, maybe if you use some of the newer testing modalities, you find there are mineral deficiencies?
Yes, a lot.
You do?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. And what do you find? I mean, even like ones they wouldn't normally think of, like copper, right?
Yes. Copper, magnesium, of course, is a big one. Calcium.
Okay, so if Tammy learns that they have a mineral deficiency, I believe she would be irresponsible if she didn't recommend at the very least a mineral supplement. Tammy, do you?
Yes.
So when people say to me, well, trainers should not recommend supplements, I agree. They should not prescribe supplements. But for Tammy to say, based on this test, and there are all different ways of testing now. There are taste tests and smell tests. I mean, the smell tests are amazingly, although they are subjective because the person has to say, yes, I smell something or not. The olfactory nerve is very, very close to the hippocampus and parts of the brain. The hypothalamus will receive those signals. So if you have a deficiency, those signals can't get through. I'm going off on a tangent. If you find out somebody has a mineral deficiency, it doesn't mean they're going to die from it. It's not like we're talking about a vitamin B deficiency or rickets or a vitamin C deficiency. But if they're low in minerals, their metabolic function is compromised. So there's nothing wrong with you making that statement. If you're low in minerals, your metabolic efficiency is compromised. That is an absolute scientifically valid fact. Now, if we know that you're deficient in minerals, what do we know has to be done to get rid of the deficiency? So why would you not say to somebody, if I were you, or what you might want to try, or here's a product that, why would we not? I think it's irresponsible not to. Again, there's a huge difference between prescribing and discussing. And I say direct people towards supplements, equipment, and resources when necessary. Anyone have any aversions toward that? Because I know many people do. Nobody? Nobody here has apprehensions about that? Because I know there are lots of people in, you know, our field academia that don't like me saying that.
You know, Phil, what I find myself being cautious of is I almost got to watch myself that I don't come off as a salesman. And that's one of the reasons I've really liked the biofeedback, because I can put all the different supplement lines in there and say, hey, look, these are the ones that resonate best for you. But I just, I'm, you know, it's like, oh, shit, what's he going to sell me now? You know, it's like, you know, because I give a good education with it, and that's why people will buy products, you know.
Well, listen, if somebody is not getting adequate protein or protein-sparing nutrients, will they build muscle?
No.
No. So if that's the case and we're taking them through resistance training exercise, wouldn't we be neglectful if we didn't point that out?
I don't have a problem pointing it out. I mean,
I know. I'm agreeing with you. But I'm just saying I want our field to recognize the importance of this because of the state of health of our population, because of what our clients don't know. Otherwise, they're going to see an ad somewhere and think that's the answer. They're going to go, tired? Get five-hour energy. No, you're tired because you're missing the vital minerals that allow the energy process to happen naturally. It's not always minerals. I'm choosing that as an example. But, you know, to me, the mineral thing is a no-brainer. If you're low in calcium, if you're low in magnesium, if you're low in phosphorus, if you're low in fluoride, whatever it is, then we got to somehow figure out a way to get those minerals into you. Now, do we know it's that you're not eating them? No, we don't know that. Maybe you are eating them and you're not absorbing them. We don't know. Maybe you're absorbing them and your cells aren't receiving them. We don't know. But the first place to start is put more in, right? That's the first place to start, and let's see what happens. And if all of a sudden you start drinking a liquid mineral supplement and you don't feel tired anymore, okay, I think we did a good thing. Same is true with equipment. I mean, I like to empower people to train at home even if they don't choose to train at home. I like to give them the option because it gets rid of a lot of excuses. And when they run into an obstacle, get out of bed and do your workout. So sometimes I'll help them find a resource to get bands and balls and maybe some dumbbells. In some cases, a treadmill. I think you have to be that. I think you have to be that resource for them. And with that, and Tasso, I'm talking to you now, I don't think we have to worry about capitalizing on ethical profit opportunities. I think if you represent products you believe in, it isn't what is he trying to sell me now. I think if you show up with a different product every week, it is what is he trying to sell me now. But if you're consistent, shouldn't you be paid? I mean, they're getting value, they're getting product, the company is benefiting, aren't you entitled to a few bucks? So I think it's okay to capitalize on ethical profit opportunities, with ethical being the key word. And with that, I would caution trainers, don't recommend, don't prescribe, but use honest phrases such as, here's what I use, or my clients who use ABC product seem to get leaner faster. Or this product has a ton of research behind it. I could email you some of the studies. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying that. I think it's vitally important. Assuming, of course, we're looking at ethical discussions on things they need or may need. Those are my 16. I'd like to create a short course on it. You guys just kind of went through it. I think every personal trainer should hear that before they're given a certification. Again, I know I'm kind of standing across the street from everybody else, you know. But when I look at the successful trainers, they'd stand behind this 1,000%. They all would wish that they had this education because they had to learn it for themselves. They had to make the mistakes. They had to be unreliable before they realized how important it was to be reliable. They had to lose clients before they realized how important it was to take responsibility for the strength of the relationship. So is there one thing on here, or more than one, but is there one in particular that you heard that you were like, yeah, I do need to get better at that? Anybody? Is anybody victimized by clients calling you too often, bothering you?
Phil, I would say for me is definitely that one, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I've absolutely opened up the floodgate on that one in the past, and it's just
yeah. And once you open it, it's hard to close it.
You can't, not with that client, you can't. Like, I'll be like, oh, text me, email me, or, you know, between training sessions or whatever, and I'll get that stupid question, whatever, pictures or something like, oh, is this good for you? We can get this ingredient, and it's cotton, you're right. And it just, because I want to show that I care at the same time, but it definitely, you know, I open up the door, or they call me, and it's constant. You get some people that just do it constantly, like maybe a couple times a week. And it's like,
all right,
oh,
so let me come back to Tony. Thank you for that, Patrick. Come back to Tony, who said, I'm crazy to pursue this. So, you know, knowing that this will take a few weeks, if we total up the hours, out of my life to pursue this, maybe more, should I give it up and just practice my chess?
Well, you go to the gym and do chess, you say?
Chess.
Oh.
I like to play chess.
Yeah.
I mean, I could use chess. That time instead of wasting. This is a total waste of time, and there's no way trainers will receive it. I'll polish up on my chess game.
See, here's the thing. If I look at that situation and I come to your peak, you know, peak weekend, 1995, whatever it was, and that course is available, I know for sure I'm taking it. You know, it's a tough call. You know what I mean? Look, if you did it now, I would take it now. So. Depends. I mean, if you're looking to say that, if you make it mass appeal, then it's got to be mandatory. If you make it elective, it's going to be just a few people.
Okay. I want it mandatory. I don't want it mandatory that they must do this. Like, I don't want somebody to be fined if they don't teach their clients to overcome obstacles. But I think it's mandatory that they hear this, because I think the great majority of trainers out there never learned this. So they decide in their mind that the successful ones are successful because they had advantages. What I'm saying is, no, they're successful because they do this. This is why. And now that you know that it has far less to do with connections than it has to do with business and work ethic, you could do it too.
Look, I'm all for it. And I love the idea. Like I said, I would take the course. I'm just trying to see where your head is at in terms of what your expectation level of the grasp that this would have. I think you're still going to affect the same people long term.
Well, I like what was said earlier. 100% should learn it, 3% can do it. I'd be okay with that.
Then I think that you can put your chess game off.
Okay.
But still work on your chest at the gym.
My chest?
Yes. Exactly.
All right, I'll go bench tomorrow. I'll do chest and tries. What do you want to do today?
Course.
Chest and tries.
Of course, it's Monday.
Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts, comments, questions about that?
I think 9 and 11 are my two that I can definitely do a lot better at.
Is contact people once a month, and that's where you spoke about the Hardman K stuff, right? And 11, document, review, reassess, and redirect.
Yeah, I think I need to get a more of a pattern that goes hand in hand with number 9, that is a little more regular. Every 4 months, every quarter, I want to see you for an evaluation, or every 6 months, you know, make myself more available for that. But the one thing that comes out of this, Phil, is in trying to build the model to, you know, for the overflow, is becoming proficient at teaching this to my employees.
Yes.
Yeah. And I have one question not related with the 16.
Okay.
Where's a resource on these taste tests and smell tests and all that stuff? Do you have a resource for that?
No, I'm not telling you to do that. I mean, doctors are doing that. More progressive functional medicine doctors, they get different mineral compounds and they have people taste it. And, you know, one would be salty, one would be sweet, and they go, how does this taste? And if they go, it tastes like water, you know, we know they're lacking something. And then the smell test would be very much similar. You know, what do you smell?
So that would be a cool thing to open up a model with these docs I'm starting to work with, if they have that capability as functional physicians.
It shouldn't be a trick. It's not like a parlor trick, you know? I mean, it is a part of diagnosis.
Right.
So I'm not suggesting that you guys really start to integrate that. I'm just saying there are ways that we can determine that somebody needs a supplement, and that's a part of it. But I'm saying that should come from doctors. There are many ways that doctors can test for mineral deficiencies rather than just looking at blood work and going, you're okay, you know, because okay doesn't mean optimal, right? When you look at the labs, okay doesn't mean optimal. We could take somebody who has a certain, let's say somebody 50 years old who has a testosterone level of 240. And they go to their regular doctor, and the doctor goes, normal. They go to a hormone replacement therapy place, and they go, oh, my God, this is what you got to get on therapy. So a lot of it is biased. But I think what we have to learn to communicate when we speak with doctors is it optimal? We're not looking for is it normal, because normal means it's what most of the population has. Most of the population is really fucked up. So is it optimal, because we want to get people to optimal. So we can talk more about that. On a future call, I'll share more about the olfactory nerve and how we could use it. But, again, I think these should be medical tests, even though they're simple to do. Can we create sort of a scaled-down version? I think we can, but we have to be careful that we don't diagnose. So let me give that some thought. Okay, so I told you about zeolite, and just a quick little review. Zeolite is a mineral. It's found in rock, and it has a tendency to sort of magnetize what we would consider toxins and chemicals. So it's been used in industry, in cosmetics, and certain things that touch the skin to remove impurities. And it kind of draws everything and becomes like a clay, and they could skim it off the top. So for many years, they've known that zeolite in the human body can attract toxins. And this is not brand new. So if you do a little research, you're going to find lots of zeolite compounds that have been sold as detoxers. But there have been two real problems with zeolite, and the reason it really hasn't been fully recognized as something that has value. One is the zeolite particle, the zeolite molecule, is too large to penetrate the cell. So it can only attach to what's in the digestive tract or perhaps the bloodstream. It cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. So when we're looking at brain cell toxicity, it can't get in there. So that's why the natural world of nutraceuticals has not been overly excited about it, because there are other things like it. There's bentonite. Some people use chlorella. These can play a role in detox, but they're not magic. But the other downside of zeolite has been, because it's taken from rock, it also comes with things like lead and arsenic. So you're sort of putting in more bad stuff as you're binding bad stuff. So it's certainly far from perfect. So that's zeolite. But it's had tremendous promise. So this very smart doctor, researcher, had been working on a pharmaceutical using the zeolite compound but turning it into a drug. And what he was able to do was create a fragment, molecular fragment, that is so small that when it mixes in liquid, it becomes one with the liquid. Now, a lot of medications, if you can, you know, picture like a vial that they come in, that a doctor will draw it into a hypodermic needle, they draw it out of a vial, those are called suspensions. Suspension is, it's kind of like when you mix your protein powder or you mix some kind of post-workout recovery powder, you're mixing it in the water. But at a molecular level, they're still big fragments. And very often with something like that, if you leave it sit, you'll see some of those particles kind of wind up on the bottom. What he was able to do was create one with the water. It became one. So the hydrolyzed clinoptilolite, which is a small fragment of zeolite, the hydrolyzed clinoptilolite fragment can now penetrate the cell along with the water that it becomes part of. So the science is incredible. The promise, I think, is amazing. But it's far from perfect. he decided not, and he walked away from, I would guess, hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, I don't know exactly, but he decided, and I think this was an ethical decision, not to release it as a pharmaceutical because he believes that it will be misused, abused, mislabeled, and will probably cause some serious problems because they'll overprescribe the drug. So he decided that he's going to release it as a nutraceutical, which means it can be sold in doctor's offices. Today, with the internet, I think it's really hard to control things like that. I think you could probably buy any drug on the internet today, and not only from overseas pharmacies, from anybody who's willing to sell it. So I don't know that really ultimately there will be that level of control, but that's the intention, that it is only sold through doctor's offices. And I've convinced him that you guys understand enough and will understand through me, will understand enough about the use of it to do it safely and to really serve as, let's build some evidence. Let's see what it does. So if you guys will send it by email. You can, I prefer if you just send it to philkaplan123@gmail.com. Don't typically use that because I get a lot of junk in there, but I'll just watch for them. philkaplan123@gmail.com. Just send me exactly what you wanted to say on the mailing label. So I'll have everybody sent one bottle. It's a little bottle. It kind of looks like eye drops. And the brand is called Cytodetox. Here's where the caution comes into play. I don't know the depth of how much you guys know about, you know, my health issues, what I've struggled with ever since the mold and the chemical sensitivity, but it's been pretty severe. I've had a really hard time finding a safe place to live, and I've used a lot. I mean, I've had a lot of great mentors and doctors and experts, and I've really come a very, very, very long way. But I think that this was the final piece for me because whatever remnants of toxins are still in the cell, here's a way to get them out. So when I got the first sample, I did 20 drops in the morning, 20 drops at night, just a little tiny drops. I have never been so sick in my life as I was 2 days later. For 2 days, I did 20 drops in the morning, 20 drops at night. I have never been that sick. I was laying in bed, shivering, sweating, stuttering. My head felt like somebody was just with a jackhammer on my temples on both sides. It was horrible. So I called this doctor. I told him, and he goes, see, I told you it works. Like, well, no, this is not the outcome I wanted. How much did you take? So I backed off to one drop, which seems ridiculous. It's such a tiny amount. But I backed off to one drop in the morning, one drop at night. I really think it was the missing piece for me. I mean, right now, I feel great. Not just good, I feel great. So, you know, this is my process, is I need to believe in things myself before I pass them along. I've watched the research. I've seen amazing things with the research. I've seen autistic children in a research study that was not yet published reduce the symptoms of autism without changing anything but using these drops. Also interesting, and I might have mentioned this to you, in the studies, those who were vaccinated got better. Those who were not vaccinated did not. If you think about that, it's kind of interesting. It kind of suggests that the vaccine may, in fact, put something in the cell that is not healthy. So I know there's a lot of controversy there. I just found that really interesting. I'm not taking sides. I just find it interesting. What if somebody has no toxicity at all? Then they'll get no outcome. But if you, and when I say toxicity, I mean people who are very sick. I mean just people who smoked years ago, people who took a lot of drugs. All of that chemical is still stored in the cell. So you want to start to release it, but you also have to understand that if you release too much too soon, it goes into the bloodstream. And now you suddenly have, bam, an overwhelm, which is what happened to me. Any thoughts, comments, questions? Have I scared you? Because I don't want you to just think of this as magic. It's not a quick process. It's a very slow detox, and it detoxes the cell. This is something that I think will be very promising to the field of natural medicine. I don't think most personal trainers will ever even get access to it. So I'm hoping you see the value here and the opportunity, knowing I'm not making any promises. They might find a flaw in it. But I'm not sharing this with you until I have used it myself successfully.
I'm excited
to try it.
Okay, Tammy first. Tammy?
I'm looking forward to trying it.
Okay, but a little. I'm telling you, start with one drop. Okay, because my feeling is always more better. Yeah, let's do it faster, you know? And I learned that lesson. Jason?
Just correct me if I'm wrong. I cut out for 2 minutes or I lost connection. How does it differ than, let's say, the isogenics cleansing process? What's the difference?
It is very, very different.
Okay.
It is very different because it has a resonance, a vibration that penetrates the cell, literally gets into the cell, pulls like a magnet toxins and drives them into the bloodstream, pushes them through the cell membrane into the bloodstream. Isogenics doesn't do that. It is a difference between what isogenics would probably call cleansing and certainly ridding toxins from the cell. There's, absolutely it does. And it's a slow and gradual process. But this does the job by itself. In other words, I believe that if you did not get somebody to eat right and exercise and they only use this, they would still get better. All better? No, of course. I mean, they need to take responsibility for their health. But it works by itself. It literally goes in the cell and does the job. And by the way, it also binds to heavy metals.
That's what I was going to ask.
And when we look at the epidemic of Alzheimer's, dementia, you guys know where the Mad Hatter character came from Alice in Wonderland? Mad Hatter's disease, years ago, was this sudden insanity where people would just get totally crazy, and they couldn't think, and they couldn't concentrate, and very often they'd be locked up in institutions. And it was actually mercury poisoning. So if you look it up, mercury poisoning at its root was called Mad Hatter's disease. Well, now, because not only of the amalgam fillings, but of course all the sushi that we eat and all the tuna that we consume and all of the minerals that are overboard and unhealthy that are in our water supply and in our air, I think it's rare that people don't have a little heavy metal buildup, if not a lot. The other thing is you inherit that from your mother, especially if she breastfeeds. So we're passing it along generationally. This removes heavy metals from the cell. Tammy, you had a thought?
I've been seeing Dr. Mike, the one that Tasha introduced me to, and he just going through that 2 weeks of what he was giving me and the candida die-off, which I started, mm-hmm. that with that liver cleanse, it started happening. And you should have seen my skin. It was scary on my face. So I took pictures of it so I went into him and could see. But then when I started going through him or his program, I was having some of the die-off. I knew it was in my bloodstream. I was really lethargic. I would have to come home in between and, you know, in the afternoon and sleep for 2 hours. I'm like, what, you know? And then I figured out that's what it was. But that and then head really bad headaches. But then it went away. So I think it's just a bunch of it died off at once.
Yeah, and by the way, that's different because candida is an organic compound. It's a biotoxin, right? So we're talking about living yeast cells. That's what candida
right.
is. Everybody has candida. Everybody has candida because you have yeast living in your digestive tract. But a healthy immune system keeps it in check. So when somebody develops a yeast infection, that is candida overgrowth. And lots and lots and lots of people today have candida overgrowth because of gluten and 1,000 other reasons. So that's a living toxin. So what Tammy's talking about, the die-off means all of these little yeast children are living all around your cells, and now you go through a process where you're trying to drive them out. So all at once, they go into the bloodstream, and they're fighting as they're dying, and you get very sick. But it's a short-term sick because you come out the other side, right?
Right. So I'm
Did I explain it well?
Yes, I like that. And that I just like the fact that, because I think it's the heavy metals that's really, that's probably one of the biggest root causes of everything with my thyroid and all that. So that's exciting to know that it'll pull that out.
Because yes, that's inorganic. So a lot of the things that will actually pull or release or kill organic compounds have no impact on the metals that sit inside the cell wall. This does. So the reason I mentioned Mad Hatter's disease is because it appears, I can't say for sure, but it appears that the epidemic in Alzheimer's and dementia has much to do with metals in the brain. We'll find out in years to come. So if you had something that could pull those metals out of brain cells, I think there's promise. Miraculous? I don't know. But promise? Yeah. This also has been tested through strict FDA guidelines. It goes through a third-party laboratory. There is no lead. There is no arsenic. It is pure. The concentration of what you're going to receive is 900. Let's just use that as a number. It's really high. This will only ever be offered through doctors. They will be releasing, a company called Zoso, I believe, will be releasing a multi-level marketing version of this product. Scares me a little because I think once you have distributors who don't really understand the safety issues, you're putting something out there that is unregulated. But it will be a much, 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 much lower concentration. So if this is 900, that will probably be about 80. That's the difference. So you're not going to, you know, take 20 drops and get really sick. But with the one I'm sending you, this is mega. So be careful with it. If you want to try it with yourself, great. If you want to give it to somebody, great. But realize it's a slow process. It also gets rid of hangovers. Just saying. So, you know, again, some of you might feel this is way out of your scope. You just have no interest in this. Others, I hope, might be intrigued. So that's why I'm sharing it with you. I kind of put up a strong argument for the difference between you guys and the other personal trainers. So to philkaplan123@gmail.com, just send however you want me to word the mailing label. And you should have it in about a week. Set of detox drops. Any thoughts, comments, questions on anything?
Looking forward to it.
How much with this?
Go
ahead. No, I'm good.
Alden?
How much would this one bottle typically cost, though?
I think about $80.
How long does it last for? If you do a drop a day?
I think it's 30 days. There's, I think, 600 drops in there. But it really depends how much you're going to use. And I think what I would encourage people to do is start with just one drop in the morning. See how you feel. After a couple of days, you got one drop in the morning, one drop at night, and very gradually, you know, increase and see how you feel. Because the trick is, let's get the toxins out without causing a sudden change in your blood chemistry.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, if you stay
with, like, some of the live movements with this, that kind of help to lift
it. I really don't know that there's much of a factor. I think, yeah, moving the lymphatic system certainly helps, but there's now one other piece of this, and that would be charcoal. And the reason that this becomes important is because charcoal is a binder. So it will draw things through the gut, and you just eliminate them. Because this will get them out of the cell, but they're still having a field day in your body. So if you go into a pretty good health food store, get yourself some activated charcoal. If you just want to go to your barbecue grill and eat the charcoal out of there, you can do that too, but I think it's probably better to get something that looks like a capsule. Okay, so I'm careful here. This is not a medical prescription. I'm not telling you. I'm not making any claims. I am not telling you what this will cure or do. I am telling you that I am highly intrigued. I've watched the science. I have not been the least bit disappointed. Every piece of the development of this has lived up to the expectations. And the fact that I have access to it, I feel tremendously privileged because, look, I haven't seen many breakthroughs over the years. I've been exposed to a lot of stuff. I mentioned creatine earlier. That was a breakthrough. It really was. It was the first supplement that really had a muscle-building benefit. I haven't seen many since then. I really haven't. So I see all different kinds of stimulants being re-released, whether it's Yohimbe, L-tyrosine, or ephedrine, but I don't see anything breakthrough. This looks to me like a true scientific breakthrough. Now, again, with the process, it may be misrepresented by the multi-level company. They may, FDA may find some flaws. Putting it out in the marketplace may show some side effects that are unwarranted. People may, in fact, get uncomfortably sick. I think this goes opposite to pain meds. In other words, if you want to get rid of a headache, you could go buy something over the counter. If you have a really bad headache, then you get a prescription for codeine because the prescription makes you feel better because it's stronger. With this, it's the opposite. If somebody's getting that multi-level one and then they get the prescription one, it will make them feel worse. You understand why? Because it is getting into the cell and pushing out all of those toxins, and now they're running all over your bloodstream and your brain. So this is why the caution becomes very important in understanding the mechanism and not expecting somebody to feel something. If they do feel something and it's negative, that may be an indication that it's working, but you want to guide them through that process a little at a time. You might even back off a bit. And following with the charcoal gets it out of their body. How long does it take to take an average human being who has heavy metal elevations and bring them back to normal? Nobody knows. This is all brand new. Nobody knows. Might it be a year? Yep. Might it be more? Yep. Might it be 3 months? Mm-hmm. So all of that is still unknown. So this is very, very early. What I really don't like is the rush to market from the MLM, because I know the developer was very stringent, very slow, did everything by the book, and now with a multi-level marketing company writing him a huge check, not as much as he would have got for releasing it as a pharmaceutical, but a check that certainly makes all his research and development worthwhile financially, they're going to rush it to market. So I wanted you guys to have it and understand it before it just shows up, just like Monavie did, where everybody's putting little bumper stickers on their cars and giving you brochures. All right. Any final thoughts, comments, questions? And any interest or disinterest? What's that?
No, that was my son. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What?
Anybody be honest enough to go, I have no interest in this. It's scary to me. I don't want to mess with that. It's just kind of outside the realm of what I do.
I think it's sort of cool going back. I think there's a whole seminar to be built on our detox and rebuild that would, you know, could be down the road for us to educate people to the use of this.
There has never been anything that does what this does. That I can say. There's never been anything released that does what this does. I can't speak to the long term because it's new. I don't see any red flags other than major discomfort. But again, it's all very preliminary. So, yeah, if we could turn this into detox and rebuild as a part of a protocol, yeah, that would be fantastic. But, again, it's premature. I just think right now it's in the try it and see what you get phase. So if you guys are up for being a little bit of guinea pigs, after I was, and I did find a comfort level with it, at your own risk.
Bill,
but I'll make it available.
Would there be a possibility that, say, after we try it for 60 days, to be able to say each of us get 5 clients and we do a group under your direction of educating them and talking about it?
I'm not
it
sure if I want to do that yet. I have to really watch the way it develops.
Okay.
I'm just not sure. And if we do, it would have to be sanctioned by, I would get Dr. Blywise to sanction it. But, yeah, I'm not sure if I want to do that yet. And I'm having lunch with Dr. Blywise next week to introduce him to this for that reason. That, you know, once we're ready, I want to have that behind me.
Good. I like that. I like that foresight to it.
Yeah, well, I've gone really slow with this. But now I feel that the rush to market is making me feel like I got to get it to you. Otherwise, everybody's going to have it, and nobody will understand the difference between what you have and what they can get. And God knows how they're going to sell it. I don't know what claims they're going to make. But if it's a multi-level marketing, I'm suspecting it's going to, you know, in their brochures, do everything from curing cancer to improving sex lives.
Is it going to be a is there already an established MLM that has it, or are they forming one?
They just released the product, and they're signing up their founders right now. So it's not out there being sold, but it will be very quickly. They made a huge investment, so they would only do that if they believe they're going to recoup it. All right? Did I give you enough to think about today?
Other kids.
Brain hurts.
I heard somebody female say something before brain hurts. No? All right, guys. Then that'll do it for today. So philkaplan123@gmail.com. If you can get it to me today, I'll make sure that by Monday morning, at least, they're being prepared to ship. And again, it's just a little tiny bottle. Everybody's going to get one little bottle. It probably has an $80 value. If the day comes that you like it, that you want to sell it, I can set you up where you would be in the same network as the doctors, but because you're an Alive coach, you will have the authority, but you'll still have to set up an account just as a doctor would. And the only way people will be able to get it from you is through your account. So you can't just say to people, you know, go online and buy it. They're going to have to order it from you. Doesn't mean you have to stock inventory, which you'd be free to. But I don't know whether or not I'll have interest in the MLM. I don't. I really don't. I'm not making any decisions there, but I definitely have interest in this level of selling it as a nutraceutical. So we do it together. If you guys have interest, I don't have a head start in that regard. We're all going to go at the same time. Until we speak again, be better, everybody. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.